Okay, any preliminary questions, issues, grading, exams? Oh, I had a question this morning about scheduling and coverage for purposes of the exam on December 11th. I think it's December 11th. We will spend the last week of class, which is the week after Thanksgiving, first, second, third of December, in review. That is, I will finish coverage on Tuesday before Thanksgiving, which gives us five classes after today. I don't know exactly how far that will take us. I'm guessing we'll finish Chapter 3, but however it is we do, break it off at a logical place and say the exam will be through this amount of material. We'll spend the last week, December 1, 2, and 3, I'll field your questions. I'll give you an outline, this condensed outline. It's like six or eight pages long that kind of summarizes the key points that we've discussed throughout the semester. I'll give that to you Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Ask you to study that and return on Monday, and then raise questions. I'm still puzzled about this part of my notes. I've got this whole section of my notes, but it doesn't show up anywhere in your outline, or where's this thing from your outline? Where'd that come from? Or I've got four elements of this thing, you've only got three. What's the story? Those kinds of questions. Or I'm still having trouble distinguishing superseding cause from Paul's graph. Give it to me one more time. That last week will simply be for you to clear up any confusion that remains, and then do the exam. Then we'll start again in January, wherever we left off, either finishing off Chapter 3 or beginning Chapter 4, or continuing with Chapter 4, just depending on how much progress we're able to make before we have to quit. Any other exam scheduling, housekeeping issues? All right. Well, we left off yesterday, obviously looking at the difficulty of evaluating claims for so-called wrongful birth. Today we have a related case with a different kind of problem, actually two different kinds of problems. Harbison raises both the question of whether our thinking on this point changes where the child is born with significant disabilities as opposed to being a normal, healthy child as we had in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case. And the second question is whether, related to that, we want to entertain the idea of a claim by the child for so-called wrongful life. And so let's look at the Harbison case and see the way in which those issues are framed and how the court goes about explaining its approach to them. Somebody tell us about Mr. Viviano. Okay. Now, one of the critical things here is to understand how this case would have been different if, hypothetically, there was an alternative medication that would control seizures that is taken by pregnant women. It's not as good as Dilantin. If you're not pregnant, we definitely prefer Dilantin because it's a better medication. This other medication isn't as good for preventing seizures, but it's safe for the baby. Suppose there were such a medication out there and the doctors negligently failed to tell Mr. and Mrs. Harbison about the availability of this medication. How would the case be different? Then Elizabeth and Christine would file a claim saying, we would have been normal and healthy but for your negligence. And we want the damages for all these conditions of fetal hydantoin syndrome. Why is it different here? What would have happened if they'd used reasonable care? Right. So the point of comparison, making sure we're comparing apples to apples here, with reasonable care, no children, because of negligence, Elizabeth and Christine. That makes it a wrongful birth / wrongful life claim. Now, that doesn't seem like a big difference, does it? Factually, you can imagine that the lawyer would have gone to great lengths to squeeze this case into the alternative I described, because who wants this, all the complication and the limitation on recovery? But apparently, medically speaking, there was no such, I'm assuming there was no such alternative, because no one would be doing this if they could have done something different. The only two choices apparently are, you have a kid and you get pregnant and you keep taking Dilantin. There is no other alternative. You can't stop taking Dilantin. You can't take a different medication. You're going to have to take Dilantin if you get pregnant and you have a seizure disorder. Your only alternative is don't get pregnant. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, and the perfect, what's the name of the medication if you, okay. So there are even worse drugs. Wow. So again, depending upon your facts, you may have a case that is what I would call a garden variety malpractice case. Your negligence caused spinal injury or brain damage or some kind of syndrome. But if the facts won't support such a claim, you may be stuck with a case in which the only alternative was not to have children at all. Okay, so that's the reality of it, and they filed the claim, the parents filed the claim saying the birth of Elizabeth and Christine have caused us damage. In what respect is this case different from the Arizona Health Sciences Center case? Right. So it may be that a court would say, along with the dissent in Arizona Health Sciences Center case, that where you have a healthy child, enjoy. And our rule is, in effect, we don't recognize the birth of a healthy child as being an occasion for damage or compensation. Our thinking differs, where the child is born with disabilities. Now, why would it be different? And let's sort of speed ahead here to the court's conclusion about how it wants the damages to be computed in this case. What do we do in terms of quantifying the damage for the wrongful birth of Elizabeth and Christine? Why not? Yes. Right. And maybe you'd even do some kind of adjustment to say they were even willing to have a kid with cleft palate or hirsutism. They're willing to take that risk. It's just the additional risk of not having a kid with this fetal height Antoine syndrome. But in effect, the court is asking you to do the same trade-off. So we do the debits again, and here, as you say, the debits may be greater because of the kid's physical needs, extra expenses, and so forth. But you still have to do the credit side, in which you take account of the benefit, smaller though it may be, from the birth of these children. Is there a problem with that? What do you think? But again, at some point, do we not have to take into account the same concern the dissent had in the previous case? Namely, that you're putting the parents in the position of comparing, you know, looking at their children and saying, we're worse off because we have Elizabeth and Christine. Yeah. Well, here's part of the explanation, I think, that will make some sense of this. The children are only 11, they're 13 months apart. So Elizabeth was 4 months old when Christine is conceived, assuming we have normal kind of gestation period, whatever. 9 months, you know, whatever. It isn't necessarily true. It happens that one of my children has Down syndrome, which is kind of like fetal height Antoine syndrome. Many of the similar kinds of descriptions. She's the third of our four children. And my wife was 40, how old was she? 40-something when Peter, our youngest, was born. Now, when Robin was born, we knew the day she was born because my wife's uncle had Down syndrome, and we were quite familiar with this. And when Robin was born, you know, we said, hey, you know, what do you think? And the pediatrician confirmed it that day. But it doesn't always happen the way many parents have. First of all, they don't recognize babies frequently, That wasn't what I sort of they're not always a pretty picture when they're first born. Well, they'll grow out of it, whatever. Even if the parents knew that Elizabeth had problems, they wouldn't necessarily, oh, it must be the Dilantin. If you have a kid with developmental disabilities or with other features that make you suspect the child has a problem, you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, it must be the medication my wife is taking. After all, they had been told by the doctors what the risks were. She didn't have cleft palate. She didn't have, you know, the symptoms they were expecting to be at risk from this medication. So it's understandable that they were not thinking, we've got a Houston, we have a problem, when Christine is born. Now, I've taught this case for a long time, and so one of the times when I was doing this case, somebody asked that, predictably asks that question, and I gave an explanation very similar to the one I just gave, and then returned to the student who was telling me about the case, and he said, "No, the parents didn't know." I looked at him and something about the answer. I said, "You know the family?" And I looked at his name card. His name card was Michael Harbison. I had called on him, looking at his name card. In fact, I'd called Harbison. We got a Harbison in this class. Why don't you tell us about that? You know, you'd think I would have figured that out. No. We'd had this kind of a conversation, in fact, a little more extensive, by the time somebody asked that question, and he said, I'm rewinding the last 20 minutes. What have I said in the last 20 minutes? I would give anything to have back. And fortunately, I hadn't said anything really super offensive at that point. But as I'm stumbling to stall for time here, I said, "You know the family?" And he said, "Yes, they're my sisters." Michael says, "Yeah, they're my sisters." And I thought, holy cow, you know. And indeed, you know, he proceeds to tell a little bit more about the case, that I was right in that their disability was similar to somebody with Down syndrome. He, by that time, of course, he was in law school. He was a first-year law student. And, you know, it's from the Eastern District of Washington. It is a kid. You know, the first is Michael. I'm just amazed that you may not be so amazed that I didn't figure it out. But in any event, they had graduated from high school by this time. And they had, I don't know, like my daughter is now 17. Jill graduated from high school in a couple of years. Disabilities, but, you know, she's a great kid. So, you know, Michael was describing, first of all, that the main suit was against the government. It says Harbison versus Park Davis, but Park Davis was the manufacturer of Dilantin, and it turns out there wasn't anything wrong with the Dilantin. They didn't know whether Park Davis had adequately disclosed the risks to the physicians, and it was the physicians who dropped the ball, or whether the physicians were giving the best information, but it was Park Davis that had hidden all this stuff. In any event, it turns out Park Davis dropped out, or they settled or something, and the major claim was against the government. And the government took forever, and I think on the eve of trial, finally offered enough money and they settled the case. Well, it's, I mean, that was the last thing I wanted to do here, but the one thing that I like to draw from this, or one of the things I like to draw from this, is these are human beings. Everybody in this casebook, somewhere or other, not that I'll ever remember that again. I mean, I'll still treat people, have fun at their expense, and, you know, do all sorts of insensitive things. But every once in a while, it would behoove me and the rest of us to think, gee, these are somebody's sister, somebody's father, somebody's brother, somebody's kid, whatever. But I think in self-justifying rationalization, which I am prone to do, this is what, you know, medical people, if you're doing surgery, you wind up having a kind of, you know, there's a sort of humor that happens in the operating room, which masks the kind of, if you actually were sensitized, you do kind of desensitize yourself to some aspects of things so that you can get the mechanical things done you need to get done. You make really kind of sick jokes about things sometimes because you actually do have this strong human feeling, and the human feeling can sometimes get in the way of doing the mechanical, technical stuff you want to do. I mean, I'm a basket case. I would be terrible in an operating room. I'd be over in the corner, you know, losing my lunch all the time, and I couldn't do anything. And much worse would it be if it were my children or, you know, something like that. I'm glad there are people that have the capacity to abstract and to desensitize. Ideally, however, as I may have said before, the ideal combination is somebody who can do both of these things. That when you need to, you can abstract, you can desensitize, you can talk about things in a kind of mechanical, technical form, get the job done, tie up those little, you know, blood vessels and cauterize that, whatever it is. But when the operation's over and you walk into the recovery room or to the patient's room, they aren't just a collection of mechanical systems. That's a human being you're talking to. And similarly, as a lawyer, to be able to talk about wrongful birth, wrongful life, about abortion, about, you know, the death penalty, to talk about these things where you may have very strong feelings, at the same time to be able to say, well, yeah, but there's also this technical thing here about the due process clause and this and that, so that you have the capacity to, you can do the technical part of it, but you also have some, there is a way of reintegrating the personal aspect of it so that you're not just a technician. So, as I say, it's easier said than done. Yeah. Well, then that's exactly what the court is thinking about when the claim is made for wrongful life. I mean, that's the basis of saying, gee, part of what we're trying to do here is compensate the parents. We've been doing this wrongful birth claim saying parents whose kids turn out to have problems that they wouldn't have had, or parents who have to shell out a lot of dough that they wouldn't have had to shell out but for the defendant's negligence, they need that money to buy the medical care, the rehabilitative care, and so forth to keep these children going. That's a good thing that we're doing by compensating the parents. But, says the court, even if we fully compensated the parents for what they're going to pay out, what about the kid? What about when the kid reaches the age of 18, is no longer the parent's responsibility? Who's going to take over? Who's going to pay for the care of these children once they reach the age of 18? But I'm still concerned about the issue. When we engage in this comparison and the parents are standing in the court saying, we're worse off because Elizabeth and Christine are here, The dissent back in Arizona Health Sciences Center says you can't let them say that. You certainly can't encourage them to say it, dangle a bunch of money in front of them and say, hey, here's some money. All you have to do is badmouth your kid and we'll give it to you. What sort of a perverse rule would that be? Is it any different if we're talking about kids with a disability? No, in fact, it's probably worse. Maybe the Heyman kids in the previous case would shrug off the fact that their parents filed a lawsuit to collect money for wrongful birth. My parents did it for some money, but when they said they didn't want me, they didn't really mean that. The Harbison kids were not so sure. Maybe the parents really do mean it. Maybe the lawsuit plays a, you know, that the kids are being, it's sort of like there are times when you can make a joke about something and there are times when it's too close, it's not funny anymore because it's too close to being true. Yeah. Well, and in some ways, it's kind of the Helling versus Carey issue. If we go back to the ophthalmology case, where the concurring opinion says, I'd like to give the patient some money here, but I don't see why we have to tie giving the patient some money to the negligence word here. Why do we have to call the doctors negligent? Can't we, like, give them money on the basis of strict liability? Well, you could fiddle with the labels, but I guess my question would be, as it was in Helling versus Carey, well, then on what basis are you making the doctors liable? Is it because they happen to need money? Well, lots of parents who have kids need money. The theory as to why the doctors have to pay for this is that their negligence caused a bad thing. If that's not true, why are we making them pay for it? Now, in one way, you could say, it's just the government that's paying for this. We're kind of doing our own little, appropriation here. It's a little legislative appropriation. We, the judges here, are just going to vote some money from Congress to be given to some deserving citizens of our country. The label we happen to be using here is that it's a tort suit, but our purpose here is to give deserving parents some money that they need for desperately needed. I had a woman. I actually met through some parents group. She had a child that had suffered some kind of birth trauma. I can't remember whether it was. I can't remember what the disability was, but it had been one of these oxygen deprivation deals where the child had motor control and mental functioning deficits because of the oxygen deprivation while the child was stuck in the birth canal. And there were some questions about the doctor's handling of this. You know, it was kind of the case I described earlier where the doctor wasn't quite paying attention to the fetal heart tones and all this kind of stuff. And she was saying, look, I don't want some big fancy medical malpractice recovery. There's a special chair my kid needs, and if the doctor would pay for that and maybe, something else, I'd go away happy. And as it turns out, that as we'll talk about in Chapter 10 under medical malpractice, you've got to prove the doctor's care fell below the standard of what, was the standard of care. And when the medical experts looked at it, they said, gee, with 20/20 hindsight, would have done something different, but I can't really say this guy was negligent. So again, the parents' needs are very palpable, but is the tort system the answer for it? Now, again, the wrongful birth claim is the one brought by the parents. So it's the parents who claim damages under the heading of wrongful birth. But the wrongful life claim is the one brought by the children. And what's the outline or summary of that kind of a claim? I think they say something along the lines that you're describing, but in effect, don't they say that, at least with respect to the economic loss, there is a claim for wrongful life, that I, Elizabeth and Christine, have these medical expenses, vocational training, whatever they are, extraordinary expenses because of your negligence. That I can recover from. What about the non-economic loss? Remember that when we go to wrongful birth, the court allows consideration of the parents' pain and suffering. So that to the extent I have had these children that I would not have had if you'd use reasonable care, I can recover for the non-economic costs, the pain and suffering. Can Elizabeth and Christine recover for the emotional damages that they suffer because of their disabled condition? Why not? Compared to, yes. Talk about apples and oranges. Remember that for purposes of wrongful birth, we're comparing the parents' life with Elizabeth and Christine to the parents' life without Elizabeth and Christine. And just as a parent may say, again, at the risk of over-personalizing this, but when Robin was born, my wife was, and I'll figure this out, she was actually 42 when Robin was born. So I think she was 44 when, no, I've got that wrong. She was 39 when Robin was born. So she's 41 or 42 when Peter is conceived. And we're thinking, wow, you know. And indeed, the OBGYN said, you got to go talk to a genetics counselor because having had one kid with Down syndrome, having another kid, and given your advanced age, both of you, you're at significant risk. And so they did the numbers, and it was a 1 in 20 risk. Peter's very normal. He's turning 14 this weekend. All too normal, I would say. But my point was, vaguely related, imagining life without, you know, I could sort of imagine life without Peter, not very well, not very easily, not very happily, but I could imagine it. The court says, you can do that in calculating the parents' damages. What you can't do is say that Elizabeth and Christine have any basis for saying, well, if I hadn't been born, I wouldn't be suffering, but now that I'm born, I'm suffering, so you've got to give me the difference. That's no can do. So, again, what the court has done is to split this in two ways. The first split on the wrongful life claim is to say you don't get any damages as long as the kids are minors. That's all covered in the parent side of it. It's sort of like the Niagara Therapy, the Kenneth Rice wrongful death case, where you have these two different causes of action, wrongful death and survival action. We want to make sure we don't double count it. So the damages for the cost of rearing the children and so forth, that goes to the parents under a wrongful birth theory, but we cut that off at age 18. From the age of 18 on, the children step in as the beneficiaries of the claim for economic damages at that point, but we don't allow any non-economic damages. So the wrongful life recovery being truncated in both dimensions, postponed until the children reach the age of majority, and limited to the economic loss, it's not nearly as substantial as the recovery for wrongful birth. And then it has all these queasy, it is one thing for us as the parents stand in court saying to us, we would have been better off if these kids had not been born. You may think, yeah, it's kind of a crummy attitude, mom and dad. Cheer up, you know, learn to see the good here. But if you insist, we'll give you damages. Whereas when the kids stand in court and say, we should never have been born, and the court says, you're right, you have been damaged by being born, that's offensive in a different dimension to a greater degree. Now, it may be, again, we could figure out a way to change the labels here, but for what it's worth, if I were writing the opinion on the Washington Supreme Court in Harbison, my temptation would be to say, as much as I would like to help the parents get some money here, I will not sign this opinion. I'm not going to go there. And a society that leaves us as the only remedy, the only way of helping out parents with kids who have special needs, or for that matter in the previous case, the only way to help parents who don't know how they're going to be able to afford to raise another child, you know, a society that doesn't respond to that in a humane way, gee, that society is in a bad way. But as a judge, I can't make that any better by claiming, you know, using the tort system to try to compensate them. Now, I think for the majority of the court, they're less concerned with the mechanics of it, or with the labels or the philosophy or the jurisprudence of it, than they are in the outcome. They want to see that the kids in this case get compensated. They want to see that the parents get compensated, and the rest of it is interesting but not nearly as important to them. As I mentioned in the notes, some jurisdictions have said we don't want anything to do with this. As a matter of statutory law, some jurisdictions have said, this is on page 67, the right-hand column. That they just say, Minnesota says, we're not going to do wrongful life claims, period. So, again, this is an area where people obviously feel very strongly. It touches all of these deep emotions about and values and morals and philosophy and so forth, so that exactly how the court's going to wrestle with a particular case, the statutory landscape with which they're dealing, obviously has a huge impact on how the case turns out. Yeah, Mr. Hall. Right. Well, again, if the facts are slightly different, and I would think that as the plaintiff's lawyer in this case, or what the plaintiff's lawyer would have tried to squeeze out of this case would be precisely the scenario you described, and to get the parents to say, even if you're skeptical that they would actually have done this, if the parents say, but for your negligence, we would have gotten pregnant without the Dilantin and have taken a chance, then the parents don't have to do any of this. Then Elizabeth and Christine show up and say, not because of your negligence we were born. Elizabeth and Christine show up and say, because of your negligence we have fetal height Antoine syndrome, because my parents were willing to take the chance, say Elizabeth and Christine, that they could get through a pregnancy without seizures and without fetal height Antoine syndrome. It was only because of your negligence in failing to warn them that they didn't realize they needed to stop taking this so that we could be spared this syndrome. But again, as I understand it, the medicine at the time was such that you couldn't with a straight face have said, I'll just take my chances. Now, again, this is where understanding the facts is critical to getting the analysis right. If I've said before, you have to be wary of the principle that when what I have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If I'm determined to have the thing turn out a particular way, I'm going to start seeing it the way I'm ready to deal with it if it looks like this, so I'm going to see that. And in fact, what you have to do is to let the facts be the facts. And if the facts turn out to be a particular way, then the issue is, how do I deal with them? So one of the ways, for example, it's been a long time since I've actually had a wrongful birth, wrongful life angle to an exam, because it's kind of hard to stick in, particularly in the first semester, because most of the cases involve medical negligence, and we don't really do medical negligence till next semester. But I did have an exam one time where it was actually in the second semester, and I had a case, the first part of the case was taken from real life. It was a claim against Washington State University. A woman staying in one of the dorms at Washington State was raped after the security to her dorm was negligent. They had left this door propped open, or they hadn't properly secured it. And in addition, as it turns out, the student who had raped her was a Washington State student who had been through the counseling center, and they had dealt with him sort of, it was a Tarasoff kind of a case. In any event, that part of it was true, and then I threw in, counterfactually, that she got pregnant as a result. So the question would be for Washington State, you know, would Washington State be liable for the wrongful birth, wrongful life, because as a result of their negligence, this child was born. So that's just to kind of give you an example how twisted, you know, I had to get in terms of constructing a fact pattern where, oh yeah, now I got to talk about this issue. But again, you want to make sure that I'm taking the facts as they come to me rather than out in search of a fact pattern that fits an analytical method I already have. Mr. Spindler? Not against the parents. This comes up in Chapter 4, the idea of parental immunity. Thank God, speaking as a parent, children can't sue their parents for negligence of various kinds. You know, I picked the wrong school. You know, I put them in private school when they really should have been in public school. I made them take dance lessons when they really wanted to play the flute. You know, I wouldn't let them play football, whatever. You know, no one as a parent is liable to their children for making bad parenting decisions. That isn't to say I'm immune from criminal abuse and neglect. You know, I chain my kid to the radiator. You know, I beat him. I'm mommy dearest. Whatever it was, that is susceptible to a tort claim. But for just ordinary stupidity, again, thank God, I'm immune. Unless, again, my caveat would be if you could bring the parents in for criminal abuse and neglect. But that's a pretty high standard. The point at which the state will come take your kids away, I'm that bad of a parent, is a lot different from the sorts of things. And again, it's not covered by insurance, et cetera, et cetera. As a practical matter, again, and from a policy standpoint, again, the tort system can't really do a whole lot of good. I mean, start making a list of all the things your parents did wrong. You know, it's a pretty long list, isn't it? And so to the extent that the tort system would get into the business of adjusting between you and your parents, I mean, it's crazy. So part of what's at stake here is the question, is this equally crazy that it comes out of somebody's fevered imagination versus having to say, no, hey, look, if you make contraceptive products or you do medical procedures where your negligence could result in the birth of children that the parents tried to avoid, why shouldn't you have to compensate for that? So again, the legal issues are there. I just want to make one last comment on this question in the notes on page 67. The very first note in the right-hand column, you've read the opinion in Harbison. Suppose it were a normal, healthy child. What do you think the Washington State Supreme Court would say about the right of a normal, healthy child to recover for wrongful birth? You're right. Now, I had the opposite impression. I thought, gee, I couldn't see that big of a difference between the logic that's used in Harbison compared to what was in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case. I figured, hey, if they're going to do it here, they might as well do it elsewhere. But they said no. They had essentially the reasoning of the dissenting opinion in Arizona Health Sciences Center. We're not going there. So, again, just as a bottom line here, for a normal, healthy child, there's a split. Some permit the thing in Arizona Health Sciences. Some say no can do, it's a blessing, no recovery except for childbirth expenses. But with respect to a child with disabilities like this one, Harbison is reflective of the majority rule. Most jurisdictions say that's fair game for a tort recovery along the lines of this case or Arizona Health Sciences. And then the wrongful life, as I say, is a small little window, not as significant as the wrongful birth claim. Anyway, we'll pick up. Oh, also, Taylor, I'm going to handle pretty quickly. I apologize for not editing the Taylor case. It goes on and on and on and on. Summarizes a lot of stuff. But there's not a whole lot. It's essentially dicta. So we'll talk about that briefly and then move on to talk about Dillon.